Good evening, everybody. How are you? It's so nice to see you. I have to remind myself that I shouldn't do this because then it looks like I'm at the beach, you know, trying to find my kids in the ocean. It's so nice to see so many of you here. I'm excited about our performance this evening, and I see that I know so many of you, but there may be some of you here tonight that I haven't met yet. My name's Laura Weber. I have the privilege of being the music director of your very own Livermore Amador Symphony. And tonight we're performing a concert that I just slapped the title on, Young Love. But it really works because we're telling a couple of love stories, one of which is told with humor and tongue-in-cheek frivolity and flirtatious melodic writing. And the other is told with absolute raw, human, tragic pathos. And in fact, all of our composers this evening were quite young when they wrote these works. I think Rachmaninoff is the old man of the group. He wrote his third piano concerto when he was a whopping 36 years old. Everybody else was in their 20s. Prokofiev, the youngest of them, in the time that he wrote this work. And of course, tonight, you get to meet two really wonderful young men who are playing two of the most difficult pieces of piano music for solo piano and orchestra ever composed, Vincent Liu and Misha Galant. So we have lots of youth and lots of love story to tell. And you'll even get to hear a jazz band in the lobby full of junior high school kids who are just getting started in the world and playing really wonderful jazz. So I'll start by talking to you a little bit about Rossini, who we all know and love. I just saw him last week, he's doing great. In my preparations for this evening, I found a recording of this work that I have to share with you. It's like 2.5 minutes long, so I don't want to spoil the overture in live performance for you, but I have to share this particularly interesting recording that I discovered. I'm sure all recognized our stars of that particular performance were Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd. And then the Los Angeles Guitar Quartet, who's appeared on this stage at least once before because I came and heard them. Thank you, LV Pack, for bringing them. And then the last little set you heard of the Allegro music is a group called the Comedian Harmonists. How many of you have ever heard the Comedian Harmonists? I knew it. 1930s German a cappella singing group that has, I think, sung all of Rossini's overtures at one point in time. So the reason I shared this particular combination of sounds with you is because Rossini's music has totally pervaded our culture for more than 100 years. It's everywhere. Why? Why is his music so compelling that it is embedded in our culture, in all of our media, everything from Looney Tunes to Chevrolet car commercials to the Lone Ranger, you know, da-da-dum, ba-da-dum, ba-da-dum, bum-bum. For me, I've been thinking about it. There's lots of composers whose music is compelling. I can't quite put my finger on why his music, his overtures in particular, is so everywhere. I think it's because his music vividly describes clear characters, extremely defined characters and moods, and those moods swing on a dime. So you go from, in this overture, the beauty in the first violins playing their lovely flirtatious melody rises up the scale, and they hit a high note, and then as they come down, it becomes ominous and angry and almost vulgar. And it changes so quickly that it's perfect for cartoons. It's perfect for adventure heroes. It's perfect for selling cars. It's everywhere, and that's a particular gift that Rossini had. And his music was as popular in his day, in its own way, as it is now. And no one was a more successful young composer than he was. He wrote this overture at the age of 24, and of course, it perfectly describes the action of the opera itself. This is the same subject matter that Mozart visited about 30 years earlier in his opera, The Marriage of Figaro. Only Rossini's treatment of the story is back before the Count marries Rosina and she becomes the Countess. It's when he's trying to woo her, and there's all kinds of disguises and, you know, sneaking around, and Figaro is the master orchestrator of all of the courtship between the two, and, you know, hijinks follow. And this music perfectly, vividly describes that kind of action and humor. But guess what? This is not the overture to The Barber's Mill. This is the overture to an opera called Elizabeth. And it is a much more tragic story. What happened in a classic, you know, first premiere bombing experience, the first performance of this opera was a disaster. It was, the music went missing for the overture, and Rossini literally had to dig an overture out of a trunk. And he was the kind of person that just composed all the time and was very quick with what he wrote and very prolific, and he had another overture, and he grabbed it, and they played it, and it is forever now the overture to The Barber of Seville, and we can't imagine another thing taking its place. So it's some of the most familiar music to us, but every time I do this piece, it's fresh, it's new, it's alive, and that just is the genius of Rossini. So we'll turn from him to something totally and completely and utterly different. The music of Prokofiev, who's much later in musical history, of course. I think he was born in 1891, I want to say, I hope I have that right, and died in the early 50s, I think 1953. And he wrote his piano concerti, both of them, when he was still a student at the St. Petersburg Conservatory. He was a wunderkind. He was a brilliant pianist from childhood on. And the music that he wrote for the piano was for his own pianistic level, which means it's unbelievably hard. And he played most of the premieres of his works. When this work, the second piano concerto of Prokofiev, was premiered, it was shockingly different from his first piano concerto on purpose. He was really trying to do something different, trying to strike out in a new, expressively different voice. But also it was music that was totally new to the ears and the audience. Comparing it to earlier works of Prokofiev or not, it sounded bizarre to people and modern and unfamiliar, and it also bombed in its premiere. And these are good lessons to learn, because if we all heard Rossini for the first time and saw a terrible performance and walked out and went on Facebook and tweeted about how horrible this was, nobody would go see it and we would miss Rossini, right? So you gotta give things a second hearing. And here are some of the reviews that Prokofiev received. Critics said that upon hearing the second piano concerto for the first time, a babble of insane sounds heaped upon one another without rhyme or reason, one wrote. And another critic described a cacophony of sounds that has nothing in common with civilized music. One might think the cadenzas were created capriciously by emptying an inkwell on the page. And you'll hear that part in the cadenza. Those of you in the orchestra, you could probably identify where that happens. But there was one critic who made the same points, but he makes a broader point, and I think he's got this right. I assume he's a he. The music, quote, left listeners frozen with fright, hair standing on end. The public hissed. This means nothing. 10 years from now, it will atone for last night's catcalls by unanimously applauding a new composer with a European reputation. It took longer than 10 years, but that happened. To this day, though, Prokofiev stands out as a completely unique voice. There are few composers who, when I hear them, really sound only like themselves, only. Shostakovich is kind of similar in that way, but with time, listeners over the many decades have grown in their rich understanding of what they hear, and now we understand Prokofiev in context. We can hear the lineage behind him, we can hear the influence of people like Glazunov and Rimsky-Korsakov and Tchaikovsky, and even a little Rachmaninoff, who is closer to being his contemporary. But you'll hear in this first movement of this great concerto, first of all, you'll hear that really you need 3 or 4 hands to play it. And in fact, I mean, any of you who played the piano, you'll be astonished at how much of the keyboard Vincent will use. In the cadenza itself, it takes 3 staffs to write the music. Normally we have just a treble clef for the right hand, most often, and a bass clef for the left hand, most often. This time we have 3. And in fact, Prokofiev has to draw lines across the staff to show you where the melody is going, to bring it out. It's extraordinary music. It is fatalistic and heavy duty. It starts with a little theme that seems like nothing. It seems innocuous, dry, totally inconsequential. It's really short, because I want Vincent to play this piece for you, not anybody else. So let me just play you the very beginning of what you'll hear. So that descending line you heard in pizzicato strings and clarinet, it comes back, but not till the end. And at the end it comes back. At the beginning it's marked, the piano part is marked narrante, which means as if spoken. At the end, in the midst of the peak of the cadenza, it is asked to be played colossal. And it is colossal. And that's, you'll hear that opening theme has a much bigger meaning when you hear it the second time. I think this must have been written from everything I've read. It feels to me like a response to the devastation of the Russian Revolution. It feels to me like a foreshadowing of what is coming. And certainly, I mean, the original manuscript for this concerto was burned in a fire that was a result of the violent aftermath of the Russian Revolution. So this is so richly tied into the history in which it was written. So the antidote to the cacophony and the cataclysm is Debussy's Clair de Lune, which is, of course, a piano work. And Debussy never orchestrated it, but others gave it a whack and tried their best to bring the beautiful texture of the piano out in the orchestration. I had never really understood, in my ignorance, that there's a poem that inspired this piece, and I'd like to read it to you. And forgive the sort of fancy English words or translations. I should be speaking it in French and knowing what I'm saying, but here's the English. Your soul is a chosen landscape where charming masqueraders and bergamaskers go, playing the lute and dancing and almost sad beneath their fanciful disguises. All sing in a minor key of victorious love and the opportune life. They do not seem to believe in their happiness, and their song mingles with the moonlight. With still moonlight, sad and beautiful, that sets the birds dreaming in the trees and the fountains sobbing in ecstasy, the tall, slender fountains among marble statues. So what stands out to me in reading this, it's a poem by Paul Verlaine. What stands out about what the musical choices were that Debussy made in response to this poem are the description of the moonlight as sad and beautiful, or sort of that to me means melancholic, that those two emotions exist simultaneously, and the description of people celebrating their love and their success, you know, as at a masquerade ball, but they don't quite believe their own happiness. There's an air of sadness behind their masks, their personal masks. And that kind of depth and duality of expression is something that music really is best qualified to express. Certainly Debussy is best qualified to express. And of course, he's the father of impressionism in music, and he literally paints moonlight. If you think about how you receive moonlight from above, and it comes to you at a great, great distance, he captures that essence in the way he writes for the piano and for the orchestra. Well, he didn't write it for the orchestra, but what you'll hear is what we'll play in the example. You hear that the piano starts in its upper register and very slowly makes its way down to earth in a way, and the root note of D flat, which is our home note where we know we're on earth, does not arrive until the very, very end of the first phrase. Work, a wonderful pianist who taught at Curtis for years, he once famously said that he regretted not learning the third piano concerto of Rachmaninoff when he was a student and too young to know fear. So, in any case, Rachmaninoff's romantic expression rivals that of Tchaikovsky's. His melodic lyricism is just as compelling. And in fact, the two were friends, and Tchaikovsky mentored Rachmaninoff. Rachmaninoff wore his heart on his sleeve. When he premiered his, well, I can't say it was the premiere when this happened, but a performance of the third piano concerto that he gave in New York City, which he played, was conducted by none other than Gustav Mahler. Talk about a sensitive accompanist, man. I bet it was over-rehearsed, too. One composer rehearsing another composer's piece. In any case, he ended up settling in Beverly Hills and became a U.S. citizen just a few days before he died. And in his fame, you know, he made a lot of money, and he gave so much of that charitably to the Allied troops fighting World War II. So he was really a force for good in the world. You'll hear that our soloist this evening starts in the transitional passage between the second and third movements, and then with a huge burst of energy, as there's no doubt, where the third movement begins, and this tremendous rhythmic drive of the piece gives way to a gorgeous, lyrical second theme, and it's really a romp, a race in a way, a controlled race, to the end of the piece. And so it's no surprise to me to learn in my studies recently that Rachmaninoff loved fast cars. And he drove them at high speed in Los Angeles and around his neighborhood in Beverly Hills. And so I can just, now I can relate to this much more strongly. And finally, we'll finish the evening with Tchaikovsky and his first masterpiece, Romeo and Juliet, the fantasy overture. There's no getting around how tortured a life Tchaikovsky lived as a gay man in 19th century Russia. He was intimately acquainted with what forbidden love felt like. To never be able to acknowledge your feelings or respond to someone else's. And he knew the consequences of basically ill-fated or doomed love. He felt it every day. And when he made efforts to woo a woman or to reach out to make a gesture to another woman, it was unrequited. And he lived through the suicides of his friends, other young men who were in the same boat, who could not continue to live in the shadows. So he is intimately acquainted with the kind of pathos and grief that is expressed in this music. This was in some ways, this piece was in some ways an assignment by one of Tchaikovsky's mentors, Balakirev. Balakirev told him he ought to write something about Romeo and Juliet and that he should do it in these particular keys and with these particular characters portrayed. And Tchaikovsky wrote something, and it was criticized up and down the wazoo by Balakirev, sent it back, do it over. He revisited it multiple times over many years to achieve what we have tonight. And I have to say, I would find that kind of interference from a teacher almost oppressive, but the results are fantastic. So I'd like to just remind you the principal themes of this work. The first one depicts Friar Lawrence, at the opening of this very meditative sort of church-like theme. Throughout the overture, as if he's pleading with the families and with the lovers themselves. The second theme is the principal theme of the Allegro of this fantasy overture, and it depicts the battle and the conflict between the Montagues and the Capulets. Feel the dueling. And finally, of course, the very, very famous melodic line that he writes for the lovers, one of his most famous melodies. I don't know how we could pick from among them in his body of work. But you first hear this love theme. It acts as a secondary theme in the Allegro section. In the English horn, supported by the violas, the first part, this long lyrical line, is Romeo. And the second sort of undulating sound in the strings that you hear is Juliet responding to him. Juxtaposes them against one another. And this is, to my ears, I can't think of a more successful work that retells the plot points of a story so clearly in musical thematic orientation, while also drawing us right into the raw emotion of the characters and the consequences of their actions. It's brilliant. I have just a moment of time left. I want to play for you a tiny bit of the original version that he first wrote when Balakirev said, "What is this? You've got to redo it. It's a wonderful work, but this is how it starts." Jump ahead. Can you play the next one? There's a fugue that he left out. The battle scene is a fugue, an extended one. Seeing it in about half.